All right, good morning, everybody. It is Tuesday, February 16th, and we're 9 a.m., and we're starting Chem 12BL. And I was just saying to the group that there's a couple of different directions that we could go this morning. So the next video of the lab, I don't have put together quite yet. I have, I think, almost all the components that I want. There's still a little bit more footage that I'd like to get in order to put that together, and I think I can complete that on Wednesday. So I'm not quite ready to set you off on the next, watching the next set of videos yet. However, what we could do is we could talk about the next reaction in sequence and look at how that reaction goes together and talk about that reaction to a degree. Or we could, it could be an and, or we could also do a few more of the synthesis problems, although that's really what I was planning on doing in lecture today. I had set all of the synthesis chapter materials away and was getting ready to start on the alcohol and phenols chapter and realized that I only did one day on that and I didn't really show many examples within lecture. And so I thought today might be a good day to do example synthesis example problems within lecture. So I was kind of holding on to that to work on that piece, if that sounds good. Which means to this morning, maybe this morning is a good time to go into the next lab that we're going to do and look at oxidations in general and how oxidations are accomplished. So the next reaction, and maybe that's the best thing to do. Reaction number two, multi-step synthesis. Of benzoic acid. And so what we had already talked about was this lengthy mechanism of taking benzaldehyde converting it with thiamine hydrochloride in the presence of sodium hydroxide and this made a molecule called benzoin is then oxidized and there are many different oxidizing agents that could be used. We're going to use nitric acid. So in this step, we do HNO3 and some heat. And we create benzyl. And then after that, we have another step that comes yet. And so, but this is the, this is the step here that I want to focus on. And then we've got another step after this yet, where we take that forward. And in order to accomplish this oxidation, when you do an oxidation, most of the oxidations are done with metals. And so most of the time what's happening in an oxidation is that you're taking an alcohol and a hydrogen that's here, and you react this with some metal in some fashion. The metal typically binds to the oxygen and so we typically come up with this type of species, and then some base comes in and pulls the proton. And when the proton is pulled, the electrons from this bond break and are pushed in to make an oxygen carbon double bond. And then the metal acts as a leaving group and it accepts the electrons such that the metal is actually reduced and the oxygen and the carbon molecule are then oxidized. So the job of the metal is really to accept electrons and act as a good leaving group, which we've seen plenty of times on carbon, but we've never seen it on oxygen in this way. And so when the reaction is over, we end up with an equivalent of essentially acid. We end up with a metal that has accepted a pair of electrons and has been reduced. And usually this is in some plus state. So we have some charge on this thing, and that metal, the charge is either reduced or goes down to zero. And we achieve the oxidation. And there are many metals that are used for this, chromium being one of the primary oxidizing metals. And so oftentimes what is used is to go through and to use a reagent that is called Jones reagent. Jones is made from chromic oxide and H2SO4, sulfuric acid. In this step, the active agent is a chromic acid. And this chromic acid if you count electrons and go through the chromium is in a +6 oxidation state. So this is called hexavalent chromium. And the major problem with hexavalent chromium, with chromium in the +6 oxidation state, is that it is a known carcinogen. So it's not a suspected carcinogen, it's known to cause cancer. It has been known that in areas where it has gotten into the groundwater, it has caused cancer clusters, and we've seen it over and over again. And so we know that this is a strong carcinogen, and so it needs to be treated with respect when worked with in the lab because of its ability to cause cancer. And so we try to limit any sort of dust, we try to limit and keep that reagent as confined as possible. And the way in which you make this oftentimes is taking the chromium and grinding this reagent with other reagents in a mortar and pestle. And so I typically try to avoid going and using any sort of hexavalent chromium. The reaction oxidizes the alcohol into a carbonyl, and the byproduct is that the chromium goes to the +3 state. And so it's actually a fairly easy reaction to track because the hexavalent chromium is orange in color and the chromium in the +3 is a brown color or green. And so you see this reagent that is bright orange, and as the oxidation proceeds, turns a green color, you know that the oxidation has been successful and you know that your chromium has actually reacted and done its job. And how it works is typically the exact same way that we were showing before. The chromium binds to the oxygen and then a water molecule in solution acts to pull the proton. Electrons kick in to make the double bond and electrons kick over into the chromium to reduce the chromium, and the chromium acts as a leaving group. And I believe the chromium can do this more than once until it achieves the 3+ oxidation state. And then the reaction stops. So that's our oxidation step. However, I try to get away from using chromium. And one of the things that I like about this oxidation in the book is that it uses nitric acid as an oxidizing agent. And nitric acid is a strong oxidizing agent without the toxicity or the carcinogenicity of chromium. So the reaction that we actually do follows the same sort of reaction mechanism, except we use nitric acid. We use 14 molar, which is concentrated nitric acid. So you have to be careful with it because it's very similar to using concentrated sulfuric acid. In fact, we don't add any other solvent. The concentrated nitric acid is the solvent. It goes through and accomplishes the oxidation, and the byproduct that comes out of this, we'll look at a sort of a proposed mechanism. The byproduct that comes out of this is NOx gases. And NOx gases, when they write NOx, the X is really considered to be a subscript, which is telling you that the NOx gases are a combination of different ratios of nitrogen and oxygen. So this is nitrogen monoxide, it's NO2, and these are red-brown gases. And they're highly toxic too, but in a different way. The problem with these NOx gases is that when you inhale them in your wet mucous membranes, as soon as they contact water, they form nitrous acid and nitric acid. And so they reform acids within, anytime they contact water within your mucous membranes. And they are extremely uncomfortable to breathe. Not only uncomfortable, but they damage your respiratory system all the way down. So these have to be done in a fume hood and used in a fume hood. And we have to be able to control the NOx gases that are being produced out of this. Mechanistic wise, when we look at it, the way in which the reaction works is similar to what we've been showing. So let's do a mechanism here. And I don't think I'll do a full mechanism, but we'll show the key sort of step here. Within this reaction mixture, the nitric acid, its job is that it actually replaces the hydroxyl group here. So that I believe that what we're seeing is that if I look at the oxygens that are attached here, that it's those oxygens that wind up being attached in place of our oxygen that is here. So what likely happens is this oxygen gets protonated, turns into a good leaving group. This becomes a nucleophile, knocks it out in sort of an SN2 reaction, or it could be an SN1 reaction where it gets replaced. But what happens is ultimately, however it does it, this nitric acid component, the nitrate ion, winds up connecting in place of the hydroxyl group that we were dealing with. And this is now set up to be the leaving group. And so in essence, what happens is a water molecule or other molecule in solution that can act as a base pulls the proton, the electrons push in. Let me do these in red, make them stand out a little bit better. The electrons push in, and then these electrons leave with the nitrogen. And what we wind up getting is a nitrogen that no longer has the positive charge on it. This guy still has a minus charge on it. And this then further goes and breaks down somehow into the NOx gases. And so our molecule is oxidized and the nitric acid is reduced. And that's the main step in the mechanism. So let me show you how we put this together and how we run the reaction. I think we start off with 0.3 grams of our benzoin. There it is. So we take 0.3 grams benzoin and place in a 5 mL conical vial. You add a spin vane and air condenser. We set up a hot water bath. In the fume hood. And we want that to be at 70 degrees Celsius. I would say plus or minus 5 degrees. Sort of our range that we would like. And then we heat this with stirring for an hour and 15 minutes. So that whole thing, when we set it up, looks like this. We have the air condenser. This guy has that cap on it that locks everything in place. We then have the conical vial The conical vial has the tapered sidewalls. We have a spin vein that we have added to this that is a triangularly shaped spin vein, so it can get all the way down into the bottom of that container. We have our reagents that we've added into this. This whole guy is sitting inside a water bath that is made out of a beaker. I think it's probably about a 50 mil beaker that we use. We fill the water up just to the height of the reaction so that the water does not go above the cap that's closing this thing off. This whole thing sits on a hot plate in the fume hood. And that hot plate is on a jack stand, so it's all elevated. And then we clamp this whole thing into place. And when I clamp it, I'm typically clamping it from behind in the way that I've shown you with jack stands before, and turning the jack stand around backwards. And I get a clamp on this guy. And then I also add into here a thermometer, and I use a thermometer clamp and try to keep the bulb of the thermometer off the bottom, but down close to the bottom, so I can monitor the temperature inside this guy. We clamp that place, and then this guy sits on an elevated jack stand. So that guy's up in the air. And we heat this to 70 degrees C. While we're heating, we stir this guy, and what happens is we get this reddish brown gas that comes out of this guy. And these are our NOx gases. The reaction doesn't start until you actually get it up to about 70 degrees. And so when you first add the nitric acid, there's oftentimes some concern that you need to move quickly, that this reaction is going to start, and that you're going to get these gases coming out as you're moving around the lab with this thing in your hand. And the actuality of that is that it doesn't do that, that it waits until it hits about 70 degrees C before you start seeing the production of that reddish brown gas coming out of it. And then it just goes like this for about an hour and 15 minutes. And as it's going, what you should see is you should see the production of the NOx gases sort of slowly decrease as the reaction goes forward. And at the end of the reaction, we simply let it cool down. So we'll start the workup phase. We cool the reaction to room temperature. Disconnect in the fume hood. The air condenser. We want to disconnect that air condenser in the fume hood because there's still a lot of NOx gases that are inside this thing, and you don't want to bring it outside of the fume hood and disconnect it and have those gases go into the lab room, in the general lab room. So we want to keep that all in the fume hood. And then what we do is we take and transfer reaction contents into a beaker with 4 mils of ice cold DI water. We want that to be ice cold because if you think about what you're doing there, you're taking concentrated nitric acid that was in this reaction mixture and you're dumping that concentrated nitric acid, of which a lot of it is still there, into water. And if you were to do that and you had this small amount of water, what can happen is it can actually boil the water. It's so exothermic. So we really want to make sure that that water is cooled down and chilled down and provided with an ice bath so that when you dump it into the water, it doesn't boil on you. Or worse, when it boils that vigorously, it can explode, it can bump and shoot out of the reaction vessel. And so we want to make sure that that's cold. And then you rinse the spin vane and the conical vial. With DI water and add to the beaker. Now at this point, what's supposed to happen is that the material is supposed to crystallize. So we ice bath the beaker. For 15 minutes. And then you filter on a Hirsch funnel. Rinse with about 5 mils of DI water. And then we recrystallize from 95% ethanol. And after that, we get our percent yield. We get a melting point, and we get FTIR. And once we confirm the structure, then we're ready to move on to the last step. Okay, so, you know, we were talking separation schemes and showing how to do a separation scheme. So we sort of understood the workup and understood where everything was going. Let's take a look at a quick separation scheme. The separation schemes for these reactions are not complicated. So we have possibly some of the starting material. We have the product that we've made. Which I flipped. And then we have nitric acid and possibly other acids. And I'll leave that as HNOX because there might be other acids that are in there. And we take that material and we add it into water. And at the point that we break it up into water, we break up into an aqueous and an organic. And it's actually liquid and solid. And that liquid is simply just our water and any of the acids, which is why we're rinsing it with a lot of water in order to get those acids removed from the product. And you also want to make sure that the product gets broken up fairly well. The two things that are going to solidify are going to be your benzoin and your benzyl. But concentration-wise, the amount of benzoin that is still there should be fairly small compared to the amount of benzyl that we made, which should be our major product. At this point, we recrystallize. And we get a liquid and a solid. In that liquid, we should come out with the ethanol. Any water that was in there is going to end up in the ethanol. And that small component that is going to be super soluble in the ethanol is going to be the benzoin. It was in smaller concentration to begin with. The solution is not going to be saturated. When we do the recrystallization, it will not be saturated for the benzoin. And so that benzoin material should stay in solution over there. The solid should really be our benzyl. And that is it for that separation scheme. So pretty simple separation scheme. All right, any questions? You guys have been quiet. And as usual, you kind of let me run. Any questions come up in terms of looking at this reaction, looking at what it is we're going to try to do, how the reactions run? And of course, in the video, like in the Grignard, I'll do all of the little technique things and transfers and talk about how we do things, all the little minutiae. There's little things like whenever you use a concentrated acid like 14 molar nitric acid, you always work with it in the fume hood, and any pipette that you use, you always have a neutralization solution right next to where you're working. In case of number one, if you drop any small drops on the tabletop, you always want to neutralize those. If there's any accidents and you happen to actually get it on your hand, you can neutralize that quickly. But most importantly, the pipette that you used for transfer, that pipette is contaminated with concentrated nitric acid. And so you always want to have some ability to neutralize the pipette so that you don't have to walk around the lab with a pipette that has strong concentrated nitric acid on it. That's just a recipe for disaster. I've had people that try to walk around with the pipette. They've tried to empty out the pipette, but a drop will fall out, hit them on their pants while they're walking. And 10 minutes later, after it's eaten through the pants, it starts eating into their leg and starts burning. And they're trying to figure out what that burning sensation is coming from until they realize that it was the nitric acid. But at that point, they've already gotten a chemical burn and they've got a hole in their pants. And so just to prevent things, whenever you work with an extremely reactive reagent, it's always good to know how to neutralize it and to have that neutralization solution there, present, and ready to go, so that you can neutralize glassware, deal with accidents, all of those little types of things. So we'll deal with those little types of things in the video. But here, I just wanted to sort of get an idea so that you had an idea in your mind of what was coming and help in terms of preparing your laboratory notebook. So now you can go through and you can take a look at the things that you need to write down and the data that's going to be taken in terms of the laboratory notebook with Pavia, of course, using Pavia as a backup source. Maybe this is a good question for you guys. We are, we are taking benzaldehyde. And converting benzaldehyde in the first step in reaction one into benzoin. What do we expect to see product-wise? Let's say melting point, FTIR, because these are our two characterizations. And so if I think about these materials and what these materials look like structurally, you know, I can ask the question, what do I expect to see in terms of the melting point of these two materials? What do I expect to see in the differences of the IR? What am I looking for in the IR? Ooh, JC, do we use a separatory scheme for the first reaction? You know what? I probably didn't write it out, and we should probably go back and write it out. And we'll be sure that we do that at some point. Higher melting point for the carbonyl. Yeah, not only because it's a carbonyl, but we've increased the mass dramatically. So when we doubled the mass, remember that the melting point of a compound is proportional to the mass of the compound as well, and also the intermolecular attractive forces. So what we see with benzaldehyde has dipole-dipole forces only. And it's small. The melting point here is that this thing is a liquid at room temp. But when we go to benzoin, we've doubled the mass. And instead of having just dipole-dipole, we've got H bonding from the alcohol. So now we've got twice the mass, plus we've got hydrogen bonding. And so we expect this to have a much higher melting point, and that this material is a solid with a high melting point. And I'm not sure what that melting point is that I'm expecting. I don't think I wrote it down yet. Let me check. It's giving me a 94.8 degree Celsius. Oh no, that's been zil. I want benzoin. Higher than that. There we go, 137. So that's the melting point that I'm expecting. Okay, carbonyl in the IR, Keegan. Yeah, so we should see a carbonyl in the IR. But if we look at the IR of benzaldehyde, benzaldehyde is also going to have a carbonyl. So we're expecting that. Here in the IR of the benzoin, we're also expecting a carbonyl, but that carbonyl should be shifted. Yes, JC, that's correct. One for the benzoin should have one for the ketone and one for the hydroxyl group. And so what we're looking at is carbonyl that is going to be specifically aldehyde. And then over here, we're going to have carbonyl plus hydroxyl. And so in the FTIR of this guy, the benzaldehyde, I don't know what the full IR is going to look like, but that's going to be sort of representative. We'll get a carbonyl in this one, and then a bunch of other stretches that are going to happen in here in the fingerprint region. And so what we're expecting here is we're expecting that aldehyde to show up in the first one. And in the second one, we're getting the hydroxyl group and the ketone. So it's specifically a ketone. And we'll get that alcohol showing up. And then we'll get not the aldehyde, but a ketone. And that ketone should move the, it's still conjugated. I think it moves this direction. And so they won't have the same wavelength for the 1700 beats. We'll see a different wavelength for the aldehyde versus the ketone. And so that's what we're looking for in those transformations. When we're looking in the IR, we're looking to make sure that we're actually seeing the hydroxyl peak and that we're seeing the ketone peak, but that we should not see any remaining aldehyde peak, that aldehyde peak should disappear. Okay. Is that making sense in terms of what we're looking for? Cool. All right. What else do you guys want to do? We've been going for about 45 minutes. Ooh, reaction one separation scheme. Okay. Let's tag that. I'm wondering if I shouldn't go back to where we introduced that reaction and put that separation scheme in those notes rather than at the tail end. I'll tell you what, I'll put it in both. We'll put it here and then I'll go back and I'll append it to the other notes so that we have it. Okay, with the benzoin reaction, this one is pretty simple too. We started off with benzaldehyde. We have the benzoin that we made. Did I just blow something over here? No, we'll come back and I'll talk about that next thing too. Okay. And then we have thiamine. And the thiamine has some pretty big groups on it. There's an alcohol there, there's a methyl, and then there's an R group that is out this way. And that thing was the ilid that was ionic in nature. There was water that we added into this reaction, and ethanol, and sodium hydroxide. There was HCl that was in this reaction that was part of the thiamine hydrochloride. So all of those things are together stacked within this chemical reaction. And at the end of the reaction, the reaction separates on its own. We don't really need to add any reagent to it. We start by doing a filtration. Because we get a liquid component and a solid component. The solid, the only thing that turns solid is the benzoin. And everything else, the water, the ethanol, sodium hydroxide, the HCl, which is really those two have combined and now is just water and sodium chloride. The thiamine is water soluble. And the benzaldehyde, any remaining benzaldehyde is a liquid. Benzaldehyde is not a solid. So all of those things are liquids. And then over here, we recrystallize with 95% ethanol. And in doing that recrystallization, we get a liquid, we get a solid. And the reason that we're doing that is we could say that there are impurities that may be in here. There could be a little bit of thiamine hydrochloride that gets trapped in that solid. There could be a little bit of benzaldehyde that gets trapped in that solid. And so when we recrystallize it, our 95% ethanol is our liquid, and the impurities, which are soluble in that, go that way. And then our solid is simply the benzoin. And so that's our separation for the benzoin reaction. Most of these have really easy separation schemes, which is really nice for these couple of reactions. Okay. So we talked about this reaction, benzaldehyde to benzoin, and what do we expect to see, both melting points and IR. Let's do the same thing from the benzoin to benzyl. Let's do that little analysis. Okay, what do we expect to see for these? All right, we got the melting point. Which one of these two is going to have the higher melting point? Good, true, nice. We're expecting that the melting point over here, this is going to be higher melting point. And in fact, we said this was our 137. And that is due to the fact that we have hydrogen bonding from the alcohol. This one, we're expecting a lower melting point. And I think we're right around 98 degrees C. And that's because it only has dipole-dipole. They are rather equivalent mass. And when you have two things that are equivalent mass and one has stronger intermolecular attractive forces, then we expect a higher melting point on that one with the stronger intermolecular attractive forces. And then FTIR, hydroxyl peak in the FTIR spectrum for benzoin, yes. So what we expect here, and we sort of had this copy, I'm going to grab it again. We'll bring this guy over, that we've got the carbonyl, the ketone, and the hydroxyl. And so we're expecting that ketone and that hydroxyl. And then on the other side, we get rid of the hydroxyl. And so what we expect on this side is just the ketone. So we expect loss of 3,400 reciprocal centimeters alcohol and shift of the ketone. So we'll see the carbon hydrogen stretches, and then we'll get a carbonyl peak. And then there's a bunch of other things that happen in here. But this thing is going to move. We don't know which direction it's going to move, but we know it'll move. But what's been lost, and what's important that it's gone, is that alcohol peak, and that we shouldn't see any remaining hydroxyl peak.
Hey, Jason, could I ask you a quick question about lab reports?
Yeah.
So we were talking about how, like, the lack of that alcohol peak shows that this kind of went to completion and that there's no more benzoin.
Yeah.
At the end of the materials and methods section, that chunk you allowed us to copy, it had all the X's at the end talking about the different important peaks.
Yeah.
Is it okay to state that there's a lack of a peak that's important? Like, it doesn't exist to, and that kind of shows that the reaction went to completion?
Yeah.
Or should we just do peaks that exist?
Usually, because you're characterizing a product, you're not trying to tell somebody what to look for to make sure that it's not there. That can be done in the discussion section. Usually in that characterization product, what you're really doing is you're just telling somebody, this is what you're looking for to verify that this is the structure. And so we don't generally include peaks that we're not expecting. We just look for the peaks that we're looking for that verify that thing, if that makes sense. But if your discussion is where you deal with that and you say, yeah, you want to make sure that when you're looking at this IR that that there shouldn't be any hydroxyl characteristic to this structure when we're looking at that product. And that's something that you can either verify that your spectrum does not have, or if your spectrum has a little bit, then you still have a little bit of benzoin that is still tracking within this product. And then we would actually look to see, did that change the melting point? Did it lower or depress the melting point as well? Are we getting corresponding evidence between the two that we have a slightly contaminated product before we move forward? Those are the types of things that you're doing.
Gotcha. Thank you.
You're welcome. And if you did that and you put like the hydroxyl and you put it in already and said, make sure there's no hydroxyl peak, I mean, it's going to be fine. This is an iterative process and we're going through, and I'm not grading that. I'm not that type of grader. I'm more the type of grader that's going to point things out to you and ask you to change things and modify things, and try to teach you how to do it rather than just slamming you and deducting a whole ton of points. Okay. Anything else coming up? All right. This is kind of what I had for the morning. I think I can see two options here that we can move forward on. One is that we could take a break here and come back in about 5 minutes, and we can do some more practice problems for lecture. We could take a break and we can come back and we can deal with any other sort of questions or stuff pertaining to the lab that you guys wanna do. I think that 5 minute break is in call for. It just depends on what you want to do after that. Would more practice problems be helpful? Or we're going to do practice problems in lecture too. That's pretty much what lecture is going to be. And I've sort of achieved everything that I wanted to do for this morning, for this next lab. So I'm also okay just calling it quits on this morning and then catching back together at 12:40 for lecture. Giving you guys time to go do other things you got to do. All right, let's do it that way. Let's go ahead and call it quits on this morning. We'll just have a shorter lecture this morning, which is fine. We're using our time wisely. You guys go catch up on other schoolwork and other things you got to do. I'll have office hours at 11. So in an hour from now, I'll be jumping back on and have office hours. So if you want to jump in and you have other questions to move forward on that. And otherwise, then I'll see you guys in lecture. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, everyone.